Access number 2877, serial 4.
Admiral Sir Raymond Rygor, reel 4. Admiral, could you describe to me some of the pre-flight checks that you would do with a propeller-driven aircraft?
Gosh, you're taking me back a bit now. well, I think it was a generalist. It hasn't changed, of course, and I still fly a propeller-driven airplane now. So you start really on a fixed point on the fuselage somewhere, and then work your way steadily around. Normally to check that the controls are working and freely, the ailerons as you go around, to check that the if there is a stall warning indicator fitted. I don't think on the Harvard there was, I can't remember, but you check that, and then the leading edge is clean and clear. Then you go down through the undercarriage and check the tyres, the tyre pressure is all right, and the tyres are in good shape, the brakes, the linings are sufficient, in other words they're not it's not worn out, the undercarriage areas look about the right extension, and there's no oil or anything dripping away from underneath. Then normally if the switches are off, you would pull the props through. I don't believe we did that on the Harvard. I don't think they liked the students to do that very much, but and then you'd go around checking the intakes on the engine, that they were clear and free. You'd have checked that the pitot and the static heads were clear, and then you'd go around on the other wingtip, the other undercarriage, right round, checking the ailerons down to the tail, where you check the free and through movement of the elevators and rudder, and right round, and then back up towards the root of the left wing, usually, which is where you climb up to get into the cockpit. So that's the full external check.
Would the instructors at that time, would they also check the aircraft?
They go around with you as part of the training to make sure that you did those things which you ought to have done.
And did that become second nature to you for the rest of your career?
Yes, it is. I mean, and I've done it now for as long as I've been flying. I still do it with my aeroplane today. That's what I check every time. As well as today, I check the fuel to make sure that I drain a little bit of fuel out of each tank to make sure there's no water got in the tank. But as I usually keep my tanks pretty full of fuel always, that very rarely occurs.
Having completed a flight, what was the kind of post-flight debriefing or routine that you would follow?
Well, it varied. I mean, I went on to become an A1 instructor, which is an exceptional instructor. So I suppose I'm start to speak as if I'm actually being an instructor. But and I can't remember too well exactly into what detail the instructors in Canada went. But they'd go over the flight, basically, that you'd done, you'd taken off. What was the takeoff like? Did you, you know, kept straight? And is it clean? And did you come, you know, pull off cleanly and climb away, and then what you were doing, go through the exercises, if it was aerobatics, if perhaps you'd got something wrong, what it was you got wrong, and they'd go through the whole detail with you to correct anything that was wrong, and hopefully commend you if you did something right.
How competent did you feel at the end of the course in your flying skills?
I felt very competent. I mean, I was very familiar with the aeroplane. I liked the aeroplane. I enjoyed flying it. I liked it. I was on top of the aeroplane. I was flying the aeroplane. The aeroplane wasn't flying me. And so I was, I was very happy.
And was this the point where you were, you received your wings at the end of it?
Yes, you received your wings in those happy days as a leading naval airman. And these wings went on your sleeve, on your upper arm, on the left arm. And whereas your RAF colleagues all were made up to whatever their rank was going to be when they went back to their service, a pilot officer or a sergeant, one or the other.
And is it a silly question to ask how you felt at that stage, finally having achieved?
Very satisfied and very happy, very confident that, it was a big milestone that you had achieved. I don't know that we were entirely conscious of what lay ahead, but we were very happy with what had gone before.
What was the next stage, obviously, after you'd finished?
Well, we went on leave then, and I hitchhiked from Kingston up through Gamrock with a Thousand Islands down through New York State to New York itself. I had a visit to New York and then up through to Buffalo, I suppose it was, the Niagara Falls, and got back into Canada that way, and then back up to Kingston again. So I think we had, 2 weeks leave, and that's what we did. And that in itself was an experience, a tremendous experience. But and then we waited to be shipped back to England, basically. And again, I don't think we went through Moncton on the way back. I came back in the Aquitania, I think, which sailed from, now where was it, New York or Halifax, and I can't remember that. But anyway, it was all a bit of a blur, and then we came back on that ship. The interesting thing on that, of course, was that because we were leading airmen, or leading naval airmen, and we were waiting on, we were made to wait on the tables of the RAF chaps who'd been made up to pilot officer, which was really quite something. Somehow a kind of illustration of what life in the Fleet Air Arm is like. It's always been a somewhat downtrodden service by its own service. And one became slightly more bitter and twisted, I suppose, which is almost the nature of the beast.
How were relations with the RAF?
Bad. I mean, they couldn't be bad, ostensibly bad, because that wouldn't be that wouldn't have been tolerated. But I mean, we sloped off as much as we could, and we did as little as we were able to get away with. It was a question of rather silent mutiny, really. But there you are.
You mentioned obviously your instructor was very keen on you becoming
He obviously thought I was an embryo fighter pilot, which I think he wanted to be himself. And although I didn't know it at the time, he must have put that on my papers.
Was there any selection in Canada, or was it when you arrived back in the UK?
No, there was no visible selection, and it wasn't until, and indeed there wasn't any when we arrived at Errol, which was the next place we went to in Scotland, where we were to be, can you believe it, converted back to British aircraft types. So then we had masters ones and threes, I suppose they were, in which we were converted to fly these British aircraft, which really weren't very much different from the ones we've been flying.
I was going to say, because obviously the Harvard was quite an advanced trainer, wasn't it? I suppose the masters.
For its time, it was, yes. And for its time, it was. It had all the characteristics that you require of a trainer, advanced trainer. It flew like a combat aeroplane in a way. It was fairly effective and efficient in terms of flying and aerobatics, and it could actually do training manoeuvres, as I said before, and bombing and things like that, and gunnery. So yes, and the master was no different, except sounded a bit different, I suppose. The instruments were a little bit different, but in those days we had rejoiced for some time in what was then called the standard blind flying panel. So the instruments grouping within the cockpit, the ergonomics of the thing were the same, more or less. I think, of course, the difference with the British at that time, the American aircraft all had foot brakes, and we in the master had handbrakes on the stick. Mm.
Was that easy to master?
Yes, no particular problem with that.
What was the purpose of this training in the UK? Was it just familiarisation with A, the aircraft, and B, sort of the air and
I think more conditions? The locality, really. I mean, where you'd, especially those people that have been flying and been taught to fly in Grove Seal. Well, we've been taught to fly in Kingston during the summer, and the weather was always good. Suddenly you arrived in the UK and you couldn't believe the weather you were being asked to fly in. But yes, part of it was getting familiar with flying in the UK. This was, yes.
And those conditions, were there any anything that you had to be aware of, obviously, because I know it would be much more cloudy and prone to change.
Well, I mean, it was the fact that you had to fly, or be able to fly on instruments as required, if you suddenly found yourself in cloud, and flying through cloud, which was almost inevitable in the UK weather. And, of course, in Scotland, you have these dreaded hills all around you, mountains, which, of course, you didn't have in Kingston. So, again, terrain avoidance was quite an exercise.
Were there any accidents, obviously, with people who chained in those good conditions in Canada, then returning to the UK?
Not in my time. My instructor was killed subsequently. He was flying with a student at night, because we did night flying there. And it clamped, and he couldn't get back. And I think they bailed out over the, where would it have been? The Firth of Tay, I suppose. And they were not recovered. I mean, I think they were recovered, but which time they were dead. But so these things did happen, and it was usually weather induced in those days. Of course, the number of aids to instrument flying were very limited.
You mentioned night flying. You mentioned earlier how you'd done the night flying in Canada. Yes. I imagine it was more different in the UK because of the blackout and
there's much less light about. In a way, that was good news because you could get confused by the amount of lights, and they would always turn the beacon on for the airfield for you. When it was time for you to come back, and so they didn't keep it on all the time. Of course, we would give it away to German raiders, but so yes, it was different. But you know, some things better, some things worse.
And you still have the rank of naval airman at this time, still?
No, we had by this time all been fixed in our ranks. I was now an acting temporary sub lieutenant, Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, and bracket A, and. So that's where we were all dressed up as naval officers.
Were most of the group that you were with, would most of them be commissioned, or would any become petty officer pilot?
Oh no, there were about a third became petty officer pilot, and I think I've made a point of putting it in my book, because it was the worst example of man management I've ever seen, because when we came back to England, we went to Leon Solent and fell in the gutter outside the regulating office, and it was raining. I've never forgotten it. And the chap, petty officer, opened the window in the regulating office. And it was the Crittle window. That's how it's imprinted on my brain. And we were always falling in alphabetical order. And so he started off an Alder, A-L-D-E-R was the first chap to be called. And he was called forward and handed a piece of toilet paper, it looked like, on which was stenciled, "This rating is entitled to purchase an officer's uniform." And that was how you knew you'd been commissioned. If you were not called, you weren't. I mean, can you imagine a more, you know, gut-wrenching way of telling people what was going to happen to them? And so I remember a chap called Barrow. He was not called, made a petty officer pilot. A good friend of mine, his damn name now, who began with an L, so he was very close to me. He didn't get called. I was called and got a piece of paper which in fact said I was commissioned, but that was my commissioning warrant. Can you believe it? I mean, it did come afterwards, but this was the first indication that we actually had that there, some of us were commissioned. And can you imagine, the chaps that weren't went away practically in tears and hid themselves in corners wondering what to do. Whereas the rest of us were then sent on leave to purchase a uniform, effectively.
Am I right in thinking that the petty officer pilots would have fulfill a different role than officer pilots?
No, they have exactly the same role, but I mean there was some extraordinary anomalies. I mean, one of the worst examples I saw of this was the same fellow Barrow that I happened to mention, who was either in my squadron or 894 when we embarked in Indefatigable in 24 wing. And one day, I mean, he was flying and made the most appalling approach to land, and then went over the side, left his cockpit on the side of the flight deck and his head, and it was smashed off, and went into the sea. And then we went, what the hell went wrong with him? What happened here? And it was his 21st birthday. And he'd been taken down into the petty officer's mess and given rum. And he should never have been given rum. And had he been an officer, then the CO, or myself, I was in the squadron staff officer, I suppose, would have witnessed what was going on and have had some inkling of what was wrong and said, well, we're not flying this chap today. But, I mean, that was one of the things that could happen. And worse things, I mean, they weren't always included in... I think they were always included in our briefings because they were always in the crew room, but... There were occasions when they were not included and were just told by the... If they were a single engine aircraft as we were, then they had to be briefed. But if they were flying in like a Firefly or something like that, or flying a Firefly, then maybe their observer would be briefed because he was an officer. And they would be told, oh, steer 270. I mean, unbelievable. Unfortunately, too believable.
And had there been any indication of who would be selected as an officer and who would be selected as a petty officer?
None at all. I mean, none at all. I mean, I don't... We had a Lieutenant Hayward, who was an engineer, who was our course officer, and he was the one that wrote the reports, obviously, or most importantly, and I suppose he... And then they went up through the chain, but... I honestly don't know. I mean, I really don't know. Here was I, without one bloody O-level or anything, you know, and got in by the skin of my teeth, commissioned. Here was my friend who had been to a public school and everything, and he was not. So I did not.
You mentioned, obviously, having then to go and purchase your uniform.
Yeah.
How did you go about that? Was there a selected number of establishments that you would go to?
Well, I went about it entirely the wrong way, being a kind of rebel, I suppose, because most people went to Gieves, who were the recognised naval tailors. Hawks was another lot, but I decided to go to they'll come to me in a minute, and I got a most dreadful uniform. I should have gone to Gieves, but there you are. You did what you did.
And so you're entirely really left up to your own devices as to where you got that uniform
from. Yes, that's right. All you have is a chit to say you're entitled to have it, and you were measured up for a uniform and you bought it.
After Errol, what was the next stage?
After Errol, we were sent to... I was sent to the Naval Air Fighter School at Yeovilton in those days, and that was the first time I knew I was going to be a fighter pilot. And all my friends, yes, all of them, went up to... Donnybristol and places like that, where they were going to fly either Swordfish or Barracudas. And I thought, well, that's what I'd like to do, is go up with them, stay with them. But I hadn't seen a Barracuda, nor understood more or less what it was like. I'd seen and heard about a Swordfish and didn't particularly want to do that. And I found myself at Yeovilton, and we were then interviewed by the chief flying instructor. There were, I suppose, 24 of us, something like that. Maybe a few, maybe 18. And I hung back. They were all rushing in to see the CFI to say, being asked, what would they like to fly? At that time, you had a choice at Yeovilton. You either flew the Martlet, the Wildcat, American aircraft, or the Seafire, the navalised Spitfire. So I was the last one to go in because I wasn't interested. And so I went in. And it was a major of Marines, I remember, who was the chief flying instructor. And he said, oh, now, Ligo. He said, right, you're here. You've got a choice of what you should fly. What would your preference be? And I said, I didn't have any preference at all, sir. I didn't want to be here. What? And he said, well, where did you want to be? I said, well, I wanted to be up in with my friends, up in flying Barracudas and Swordfish. I couldn't believe it. They were stunned. And they said, well, you aren't. You are here, and you are down to fly fighters. And if you had, and you have to make a choice between the Wildcat and the Seafire, and which one would you go for? I said, well, the Seafire, I suppose. And he said, well, you're extremely lucky, because that's what we got you down for. So it was all predestined, although I didn't know it, and so I found myself as an embryo Seafire pilot.
With that, I take that the familiarisation is slightly different, because all the other aircraft you've flown, you would often go up with an instructor, wouldn't you? I imagine the C5 wasn't dual control.
No, it's a single seat, and you just were, you got checked out in the cockpit, and then you were sent solo. And most of the instructors were chaps who'd been in the Fleet Air Arm for a few years, had been flying already, and quite a number of them in combat. And they were all a bit, gung-ho, I suppose, in a way. Mine was, I can't remember his name now, particularly so. And I went solo, all right, and that was fine. And CFAR was not the easiest aeroplane to land, but once you got used to it, it was all right. And then instructions started. And, the first instruction I had was to be told, right, we'll get you to do some formation. So I formed up on this chap, and he then took me low-level flying around the wireless masts at Sparkford, as I recall, or somewhere near Yeovilton, when he had a girlfriend there, and I was paralysed with bloody fear as all these pylons were whistling past me as I was flying tactical with them, and that was considered to be a good old-type instructor flying. And then I'm back to Yeovilton, and that was it. And most of the flying there, after you'd done the formation flying, was on gunnery, at which I was extraordinarily bad. But it didn't seem to make any difference in the end. Although I think there was a very nice chap called Constable, I recall, who was an instructor on air warfare. And he obviously thought it was a terrible shame that Lago was not able to hit the drogue better than I was able to... and I was able to miss it. But, and of course, the other thing was that the only recreation was to go down to the pub at night. And I was not a drinking man, so it was always a bit... But I was always very good at singing songs and standing on the table and performing and various things. And if I'd make a half a pint of beer after all night, I would. But that was not always easy.
Could I ask again about the C5, because you said it wasn't very easy to land. Could you give me some idea of the characteristics of it?
Yes, it was very light on the elevators. It was very light, so that if you came into land and pulled the stick back to flare it a bit too soon or a bit too fast, it would balloon. And then you'd be in for, you'd push the nose down, then you'd bounce, and then it was a great performance. But... And the other thing about the CFAR, which made it totally unsuited for to carry a landing, because it had been designed as an RAF fighter, was I believe that 60% of the shock of landing in a CFAR was taken by the tyres, and only 40% by the oleos, whereas American aircraft were taking 60% of the shock of landing in the oleos, great big oleos that would absorb the buffeting you've got on a flight deck, and quite a small proportion of the tyres. So there was a tendency of the CFAR to bounce, or the Spitfire to bounce. You could wheel it on, which you could do quite safely if you put it down gently. It was a tail aeroplane, so it did have a tendency to swing on landing, but not very large.
I've heard that some pilots found it quite constricting within the CFAR because it wasn't a very large cockpit. Did you find that?
No, I'm a small guy anyway, but I always had plenty of room in the cockpit. It didn't bother me at all. What was bad about the Spitfire was the view, because the minute you came into land in this attitude, you were looking over the nose. The minute you kind of pulled the nose up to flare to land, then of course you lost sight of the runway of where you were landing. In fact, the amusing thing was when we were disembarked up in the Orkney, subsequently at Kirkwall, Hatstone, the main runway used to be the old road out of Hatstone, and so it was only quite narrow. The only reason away in a CFAR, you knew you were on the runway, but if you couldn't see it. If all you could see was grass either side, you were on the runway. But the great difficulty was with it was deck landing. Not operating it from shore.
And I take it visibility would have been quite difficult, though, taxiing, would it, or that sort of thing?
Well, you had to move the aeroplane from side to side. You'd had to taxi it by moving the nose from side to side so that you could see where you were going. And, of course, it did have a tendency in the summer, not in the winter, to overheat. You could, if you spent too long on the ground, then the dear old Merlin would start to get very hot indeed. You wouldn't like that at all. But no, the main difficulty was landing, because the other thing was, in those days we had, well, all the aeroplanes had what was known as kidney exhausts. That is to say, they had an exhaust which came out of the manifold like this, and then there was a kind of spout thing that came back like this. And so when you were looking out of the cockpit, you had all this stuff in front of you. And of course, if you were to fly them at night, you had blue flames coming out of there that you wouldn't see during the daytime, but at night time you could see them, or they would blind you completely. But so it was deck landing was the difficulty, not... And we did endless MADLs, that's the ADLs as they were called, aerodrome dummy deck landings. And round and round and round and round, with the batsman batting you all the way around, see if you got it right. And I fairly quickly found that if I put my cheek on the door, which you had to open one notch to stop the hood coming forward, if you were to have a heavy landing, it would jam and you wouldn't be able to get out. So you open the hood, you open the door one notch, stop the hood coming forward, then, because you'd landed with the hood open, I could put my cheek on the door and peer underneath the exhaust, and I could actually frame the batsman in the little kind of vision there was under there. This meant you were in a very high attitude, which was fine for deck landing, but very close to the stall. So you'd come in hanging on the prop and then put it down, and that seemed to work fine, although it led to disaster. But there you are.
How did it handle in the air, the Seafire, as an aircraft?
Very well. I mean, it was, once it got going, it was fine. You had a certain amount of swing on takeoff. Once it was up to its kind of cruising speeds, 180, 200 knots, it flew perfectly well. It was able to pull quite a bit of G. You could do good manoeuvres in it. It was a nice airplane to fly. I mean, I thought it was a beautiful airplane to fly at the time. Many years later, when I was asked for an air display, if anybody here has flown a Seafire, and I said, yes, I've flown a Seafire, would you fly it on the air day? I couldn't believe, I'd been flying jet aircraft for some years then, I couldn't believe what a little rattle trap the damn thing was, but there you are. That's what I thought at the time, you know.
You mentioned, obviously, the dummy deck landings. In that case, is it a case of circuits and bumps,
yeah,
really?
Yes, it is. But at low level. You'd be doing it at, certainly no more than 500, 200 or 300 feet, as you would in a carrier around the circuit, then turning into the approach and picking up the batsman, and then coming on the approach under the batsman's control.
Is the airfield marked out as such for the length of the carrier?
The runway was marked out, but the airfield, no, it was just a regular airfield. You got used to where to turn, and of course it very much depends on the wind. Very much.
And I believe that the approaches employed at that time by the Fleet Air Arm and the American Navy were different in the sense that
The approaches were more or less the same. I think the Americans tended to have a more flat approach. But the great difference was that the controls, that the instructions that were given by the batsman were opposite. In England, if the batsman put his backs down low, that meant you're too low, go higher. In America, it meant the reverse of that. And so there was a bit of a job for American-trained pilots to convert to the British system, but I had never faced that, so as far as I was concerned, it was the way it was.